All right. Good morning to everybody again. We're going to sort of jump in where we started last week, but I need to roll the clock back a little bit and just do a quick review, partially because I found some additional sources or resources that will just help make the discussion that we had last week a little bit easier, and then hopefully kind of bring this whole subject to a conclusion. But we were in the midst of discussing the conquest of Yerushalayim, so I am going to share my screen. Let's put the video up here. All right. So this is where the text we were looking at over the last couple of weeks, starting with Pasuk Vav, Ve'elech ha-melech va'anashav Yerushalayim, ela yevusi yoshev ha'aretz, ve'yomer le-David le'mor lo tavohena ki im hesircha ha'ivim me'apischim, le'mor lo yavo David hena. David and his men went to conquer Jerusalem from the Jebusites, and the Jebusites who spoke to David, saying, "You shall not come here unless you remove the blind and the lame." Ki im hesircha ha'ivim v'apischim. Thinking, lemor, lo yavo David hena, that David would never do it, and that ultimately, therefore, it would be a way of preventing David from entering Jerusalem. David nevertheless took the stronghold of Zion, city of David. Whoever smites the Jebusites and reaches, touches, or engages the Tzinor, we'll talk about that today. And the lame and the blind, despised of David. Wherefore they say the blind and the lame, or the blind and the lame say, he shall not come into the house. David dwelt in the stronghold, called it the city of David, built around from the Milo and inward. All right, those are the psukim. Kind of just a quick review of where we were at. So we spent most of the discussion last week focusing on the question of who are these blind and lame and what do they represent? Why are they so significant in the story? And we offered several possibilities. I just going to pull back up that source page. This is the same psukim in the source page that I think I emailed out. So if you got it, great. If you didn't get it, then let me know, because that means that you're not on my email list. So I will I'll correct that. So we had several possibilities. Rashi translated the Iver and the Pesach as representatives of some kind of idol, and links them to a story in Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer, famous Medrash, that Abraham had sworn to Avimelech back in the days of Sefer Bereishit that he wouldn't take Yerushalayim from the Jebusites. And that the blind and the lame represent Yitzchak and Yaakov, respectively, and kind of the oath written on those statues. Right? Yitzchak because he's blind, Yaakov because he was lame. That is one possibility. Again, it's very midrashic, and it adds much to the story that's not in the text. And so I'm going to leave that as a kind of to the side, least likely of the interpretations that we're going to work with. But nonetheless, it is the Medrash and very often quoted by the Mefarshim. The Radak, quoting in Ibn Ezra, who says that the blind and the lame represent the a kind of taunt to David, as if to say, this fortress is so strong that afilu ha'ivim me'apischim, you can't conquer it even if all you were fighting against were blind and lame. As if to say, they'll prevent you. As if to say, he actually put on the walls, on the ramparts of the walls. Soldiers who were crippled or blind, and he used them as a taunt. And that actually is the interpretation that appears in Josephus. And we, again, this is just a quick review. We saw this last week also. Josephus actually says exactly that. The Jebusites, who inhabitants of Jerusalem and were by extraction, Canaanites shut their gates and placed the blind and the lame and all their maimed persons upon the wall in a way of derision of the king, and said that the very lame themselves would hinder his entrance into it. And that is where the story, and I think that for the most part, I think most of the commentaries, sort of contemporary Mepharshim, saw this suggestion of Josephus as a kind, and in some of the Mepharshim, it's kind of the most relevant or plausible interpretation. I mentioned last week this suggestion of Yigal Yadin, and I was a little bit unsatisfied with it, not in terms of the interpretation, but in the fact that I had this single quote that was in Hebrew and kind of was translating it. And I decided to go looking for the text. So I, with a little bit of resourcefulness, I found the actual book in English translation secondhand. And so now I have the privilege of sharing with you this, which is really an extraordinary read. So I'm going to jump. Okay, so this is now a photocopy of the section of Yigal Yadin's book. The book's title is The Art of Warfare in the Biblical Lands. Yigal Yadin is a very interesting persona. He was a general in the army. He was also in the Israeli army. He was an archaeologist and was also a politician. He had sort of three careers. Probably remembered most for his military career and his archaeological prowess. But he talks about the story here of the conquest of Yerushalayim, and he talks about it on three levels. I'm going to skip the first two. I'll come back to it. He talks about the Tzinor, but we haven't gotten to the Tzinor yet, so I'm going to leave the issue of the Tzinor for now and start from this paragraph here, which says, "But most baffling of all." So this is what Yadin deals exactly with our question. Okay, I'm just going to read it because it's just fascinating in itself. "Most baffling of all is the reference to the lame and the blind. What are such people doing on the walls of a fortified city? Why does David offer a high premium, the prize of chief or captain, to the first man who smites them? Generally accepted explanation follows that of Josephus in his Antiquities, and this is the quote from Josephus that I just shared with you. If they put the blind and the lame as a way of derision, they did this out of contempt of his power and as depending on the strength of their walls." Okay. I want to show you those walls in a second. They're really, you don't really appreciate what we're dealing with until you understand the topography and the military protection. Actually, let me do that right now. I'm going to come back to this. Let me just come back to here. This is a very interesting picture I found. It is an artistic rendition of what the stronghold of the Jebusites looked like. And so what you're looking at is essentially Ir David up here to the top of this picture is what is today Har Bayit, Har Moriah. The walls of the old city kind of go around here. I don't know if you can see my pointer. Can you see my pointer? My mouse?
Right. Yes.
Yes.
Okay, good. So yes. This is the stronghold. And if you're standing here in the lower valley, Nachal Kidron, Gebe Ben Hinnom, if you're standing here in the two valleys to the south of Jerusalem, and you're looking up, that is an extraordinary fortress because the hill itself is very high. And then on top of it, you have a wall. And that's like a recipe for an impossible conquest. Here's another picture of the same wall, although from a slightly later stage. This is the wall when David comes to conquer it. And actually, this is Ir David. This is already as it's rebuilt by David. But you can get a sense of it, because more or less in the Jebusite period, it looked similar and it had a similar structure. This is the version of it that was rebuilt by David, because that's David's palace. But nonetheless, this is what it looks like. So when you're standing on the south and you're looking up and you see this towering wall, followed a towering hill, followed by a towering wall, and you're down below, you're like, how are you going to do this? Okay, and that's a picture of the wall in the time of the from the Canaanite era and the Jebusite version of the wall. Okay, so I'm very appreciative of the fact that somebody had a camera in those days and took these pictures for me, but I'm going to leave that and we will come back. So okay, so back here. But it is far from reasonable. This is back to Yigal Yadin. It is far from reasonable to suggest that the Jebusites were so sure of themselves, their power, and their strength of their fortifications, that they could feel themselves free to be derisive of David. It seems to me quite the reverse. David was going from strength to strength. His rival Saul was dead. He had been crowned king of the tribes of Israel and Judah in the entire area around Jerusalem. On what basis would the Jebusites have felt themselves secure in their own strength against David, whose prestige as a powerful military commander must have been a byword in the land? It seems that the very opposite was the case. The Jebusites were in a hopeless position. Most of the cities near Jerusalem had either been captured by David or had gone over to his side. The Jebusites must have considered that they did not stand a chance against him. As a last desperate effort, so it's sort of the opposite perspective in Josephus, as a last desperate effort, they decided on an action which involved the blind and the lame and which was calculated to strike terror into the hearts of David and his army and prevent them from even attempting to attack the city. It apparently succeeded, for David was forced to announce a formidable prize for the most valiant of his heroes who would dare to be the first to attack the Jebusites. What was this Jebusite action? What was this Jebusite action, and what was its connection with the lame and the blind? I love the spelling in this text. It seems to me that much enlightenment of this problem can be gained from a document found in Bagoskoi, the site of the capital of the Hittites. This document deals with the ceremony of oath-taking by the army, a solemn ritual ceremony where the men of the Hittite forces were made to swear allegiance to king, queen, and country. The presiding officer, or officiator, was a priest. The rites were symbolic. Their purpose was to instill a mighty fear into the hearts of the troops should they dare to break the oath of allegiance and betray the king. At one, for example, the priest would heat wax in front of the assembled troops as it melted, and he would thunder, "Whoever breaks these oaths, let him melt like wax." At another, he would pour water on fire, declaiming, "Just as this burning fire is snuffed out, whoever breaks these oaths, let this man's vitality, vigor, and future happiness be snuffed out." And now comes a part of the text which I believe is of direct relevance. One of the rites of the Hittite oath-taking ceremony is described thus. They parade in front of them a blind woman and a deaf man. And you speak as follows. "See, here is a blind woman and a deaf man. Whoever does evil to the king and queen, let the oaths seize him. Let them make him blind. Let them make him deaf. Let them blind him like a blind man. Let them deafen him like a deaf man. Let them annihilate him, the man himself, with his wife, his children, and his kin." The context of the ceremony, it seems to me that we can now understand what the Jebusites were trying to do as David and his men amassed to attack the city. Recognizing the hopelessness of their plight, incapable of withstanding an assault, they tried to deter David from making the attempt. This they did by stationing a number of lame and blind people on the wall or near the gate and staging something similar to the Hittite ceremony. Important to remember that the Jebusites themselves are Hittites, so it's not such a far off cry.
Did you just lock up?
Excuse me? Was that a question? Hello, did I lose you all?
How can we lose him if we're all here?
He'll come back.
Maybe he doesn't know we're not there.
He doesn't know.
There you go. Okay, sorry about that. I lost you all there for a second. Suddenly it just got like my whole Zoom crash, but I don't know at what point I lost you. So
we were all the time together.
Say that again?
Didn't see you or hear you.
Yeah, no, it all froze and crashed, but that's okay. I'm back online. So my question
you were on the Rabbi, you were on the paragraph about the last thing was putting the lame in the blind up to scare them.
Right.
Okay. Did we read this paragraph? They parade in front of them a blind man and a blind
man?
Yes. Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, we got down to the paragraph.
You got down to this they did by stationing a number of lame and blind on the walls. That's where I think we left you.
And then I just crashed. Okay.
Yes.
Thus, this they did by stationing a number of lame and blind people on the wall or gate or near the gate and staging something similar to the Hittite ceremony. That's when I said that the Jebusites themselves are a subsect of the Hittites. So this is not so far afield. Using the same ritual symbolism to strike fear into the hearts of David's men, crying, except thou take away the blind and the lame, thou shalt not come hither. Now, one second, one more piece of it. The phrase is incomplete and was probably only the beginning of an oath which ended with the threatening curse of blindness and maiming to any who would dare lay hands on the blind and the halt and the halt or on the Jebusites in general. And the book of Shmuel records the utterance of the Jebusites with the utmost brevity. Nevertheless, adds immediately to this quoted sentence, Lamor thinking David can't come here. In other words, the Jebusites felt that David would not dare attempt an assault against the power of the oath and the magic. And apparently, their threatening curse and not their derision, unlike Josephus, had its effect on David's men. So that David was compelled to offer a substantial reward to the man who would perform such an act of heroism. And what was this heroic act? Not breaching the wall and capturing the city, but doing just one thing, being the first. Kol makei yivusi v'gabetzinor v'tayibim v'tapitzrim. To being the first to rise and go forward and strike the Jebusites, the blind and the halt, and demonstrate thereby the entire army that they need not fear to defy the power of the oaths and the witchcraft of the Jebusites. And that was where Yoav ben Tzruiah did. So the advantage to this interpretation, I think, and this is sort of a little bit of my bias, is that it, besides having a kind of an archaeological twist to it, it also gives us an explanation, a little bit of an explanation as to why the Tanakh kind of mentions this, but doesn't spend a lot of time explaining it. Like if it was so central and so important to the overall message of the story, why is there so little attention in the text? It's like half a sentence paid to the story of the Jebusites. And that would fit in the context overall of Tanakh, which generally tends to give very little credence or very little support to the world of magic and the occult. Meaning, when it deals with issues related to the Canaanites' idolatrous practices and how we interacted with them, we have the Nevi'im's diatribe against the world of Avodah Zarah. We do not spend a lot of time in Tanakh describing the ceremonies of magic and occult and Avodah Zarah, and that's intentional. So that would also give a little bit of credence to why the Navi kind of shortens the phrases here. right, so that's the story of Yigal Yadavid. Yeah.
So are we to assume that David had a little bit of problem with this Avodah Zarah, or was it?
No, I don't think I don't think it's a question of a problem with it. I think it's a function of how effective, as a tool of fear, was it in demotivating his men. In other words, you're dealing with the question of motivation of an army. And ultimately, therefore, David has to find a way to get around that fear in the army. And that, coupled with the wall as it looks, as you can see, the formidable wall combined with the derision and the black magic, if you will, of these statements about the Iver and the Pisach, that kind of, if you will, spooks, or at least according to Yadin's theory, spooks his men to the point where David has to remotivate them. And the remotivation comes in the form of this offer to be the leader of the army. I'm going to hold this for a second because I want to come back to the last point that we did not address, sort of chronologically the earlier point, and that's an understanding of the Sinor, because it dovetails, it connects to the question of the Iver v'Pisach, and then I'll pull it all together. But the other question that the Mefarshim struggle with, including Yadin, who addresses it, I'll show you in a second, is the question of the Sinor. Let me come back to this verse. When David responds to the taunt of the Jebusites in Pasuk Chet, he says the following: "Vayomer David bayomahu, kol makir yibusi v'yiga batzinor ve'et apitzchim ve'et ivrim." Now, the way this has to be read, and that's sort of almost universally accepted, is that this phrase "kol makir" appears twice. Kol makir yibusi v'yiga batzinor. Anyone who smites the Jebusites, whatever this phrase is, touches the Tzinor, and the makeh, who smites the Pisrim and the Ivrim, right? Concept called kom moshech atzmo v'acherimo. You take the phrase, the key phrase of a sentence, and assume it's written twice for each half of the phrase. So kom makeh yivusi, v'kom makeh t'pisrim et ivrim. You have to kind of process it together, just grammatically. So David is offering a prize. It will be the, as it says in Devarim, the head of the army, to whoever manages to smite the Jebusites and Yigabat Sinor. What is this Sinor that is the only reference we have to the methodology of how this city was conquered? Two words, Yigabat Sinor. And here the Mefarshim are all over the map, literally. Let's come back to the sources. What is the Tzinor? So Mitzvah Tzion says the Tzinor is the name of a tower. Shem Migdal. So kol makeh yivusi v'yigah b'tzinor, whoever gets up that tower. And big tall walls, tower. Rashi similarly says, Tzinor lashon gova migdal, the height of a tower. Kisham ayun netunim kochavim u'mazalot shelem. And that's where they stationed these idols, according to Rashi. They were idols, according to others, they were the blind and the lame. They were stationed on top of this tower. And so David is saying, Ko makeh yivusi v'yigabat tzinor, go v'etas bishchim etayivim, go conquer that tower. And go conquer those Ivrim and Pisrim. The question that the later Mefarshim ask is, where's the connection between the word Sinor and the word Migdal? It doesn't seem to be any connection between a fortress or tower and the word Sinor. Typically, the word Sinor actually has only one other connotation in Tanakh. It only appears in one other place. And that's in a pasuk in Tehillim, Tehom el Tehom kore, l'kol tzinorecha, kol mishbarecha v'galecha alai avaru. The depths called out to the voice of the tsinor, all of the waves and the storms that passed over me. In other words, talking about a wave of water, mishbarim v'galim, sort of these waves of tidal waves of water passing over him, and the tsinor has something to do with water. Right? That was seemed to be the connotation of this pasuk, that it has something to do with water. Unclear exactly as to what, but that would seem to be the assumption of this word, tsinor, something to do with water.
I mean, rabbi in modern Hebrew, it's pipe.
Yes, and that's taken from this pasuk in Tehillim. Okay, in modern Hebrew, it's a pipe, but that's taken from this pasuk. That clearly has no bearing on what biblical Hebrew would do with it, because not always is there a correlation. So we're left with this mystery. What do we do with the tsinor in this context? So there's a theory, and it's recorded in Yigal Yadin's book. He has two theories. I'll show you one of them. And we'll show you the other in a minute. This is typically the interpretation or the understanding of this by most archaeologists and scientists today. The word gutter posed a problem. To what could it refer? The tsinor. The fortress of Tzion was situated on a hill just south of today's old city of Jerusalem. And archaeological excavations of the site revealed a vertical tunnel by which the inhabitants of the Jebusite city could reach an outside well in the time of siege. That outside well was called, anybody know?
Can you still go in it today?
You certainly can.
It's like something, somebody's tunnel.
Well, it's a separate tunnel, but the Shiloach tunnel, but the Gihon Spring is the name of the water.
Oh,
spring.
Yes.
Okay.
Oh,
yeah. Gihon, yes. Spring. So this is the story of the Gihon Springs. Gihon Springs are outside of the walls, and this led some scholars to relate the gutter to this tunnel, suggesting that David was calling for his men to storm the city through the tunnel. Says Yigal Yadin, but this hardly is feasible, for the tunnel was narrow and vertical. Remember the sentence? I'm going to challenge Yigal Yadin on this one. But remember the sentence? We'll come back to it. Hardly feasible, for the tunnel was narrow and vertical. So Yadin suggests an alternative reading. An alternative theory suggested by the late Professor Sikenik is to translate the biblical Hebrew tsinor not as gutter, but as a weapon, rather like a three-pronged pitchfork or a trident. The Hebrew letter for and or vav, which is the first of the next word, ve'etapischim, by moving this letter vav back one space in the context in the text and reading it as the suffix of tsinor rather than a prefix for the word that succeeds it, we would get the following phrase. Now, let's try to understand what he's talking about. If you, how do I do this? There's a way to annotate this. Okay. All right. You would get the phrase not komake yivusi v'yigabetzinor ve'etapisrim etayvrim, but you'd get the phrase komake yivusi v'yigabetzinoro etapisrim etayvrim. You have to move the vav from the beginning of the word ve'et to the end of the word tsinor, which is not an uncommon phenomenon in the Tanakh. We would get the following phrase, whoever smites the lame and the blind with his trident. And that is Yadin's suggestion, totally ignoring the fact that the only reference that we have to the word tsinor in Tanakh has something other than here, has something to do with water. And he kind of ignores it. So I'm not convinced, but this is a question itself. Hardly feasible, for the tunnel was narrow and vertical. So what are we dealing with? So for many, many, many years, and you'll hear it anytime you go to Israel, and if you go visit Ir David, I'll show you the video clip of this the story in a second. You go visit Ir David, you will find that somewhere along the line, they're going to take you into the underground tunnels of the Gihon Springs. Here is the Gihon Springs. It sort of sits in the base of this. Actually, if you look here in this picture, can you see this is the wall of the old city? Do you see these walls here protruding?
Mm-hmm.
This is where the Gihon Spring is. It's outside the walls of the Jebusite city. So you need to get that water into the city, number one. Number two, you need to protect the city and its source of water. Because in a walled city, the source of water is always most critical. And that's really the primary issue here, is how to protect the water source of the city. So they had actually an underground tunnel system before the Chizkiyahu's famous tunnel, in which they found, there's like a feeder tunnel, and there's a horizontal tunnel, and they found this vertical shaft. This was discovered by an archaeologist by the name of, his first name, his last name was Warren. Today it's referred to as Warren's Pier. And if you go to the excavations in Ir David, they'll take you through these tunnels, and you can see this vertical shaft. And the theory is, this is what it looks like from the inside. You're looking at it from the inside, just a long shaft, a long hollow tunnel. Warren shaft discovered in the 19th century by Charles Warren. Okay? And the theory is this was the water system of the ancient city of David. That we know. That it was the water system. And so the theory of Kol Makei Yusivi Gabet Sinor is that David was not just telling his people, okay, whoever conquers the city will become the next leader, but he was giving them a battle plan. And the battle plan was to recognize that the most important thing that David has to do to win this city is to get inside. Now, he's not going to get inside by climbing this wall. Just not. When the Jebusites are sitting on the top of it, and you are sitting down below in this valley, you are not going to get inside by storming the wall. But you can get inside if you figure out a way to enter the city through the water source of the city. And that is not a new tactic. That is a very common biblical tactic. I'll show you an interesting story. Actually, if we're going to do this already, not so far from where we are right now, Perek Yud Bet, conquest of the city of Ammon, or Bat Ben Ammon. There was a siege for several years, and then at the end of the siege, as the siege was broken, Pasukhov Zion. Vayishlach Yoav Malachim El David. Yoav sends messengers to David saying, Nilchamti b'Rabah. I fought against Rabah, which was a big walled city. Gam lakadati et Ir Hamayim. I have taken the city of the waters, meaning I've breached the walls, and between the two walls of the city was the water source for the city. Once you breach the water source, at that point, the city falls. And so he calls David to the final stage of the battle. And that is not remember the battle in Gibeon, when Albrechat Gibeon, on the pool of Gibeon, between Yoav and Avner. Right? That battle started because whoever controls the pool of water controls the city. You control the water source, you control the city. That's ancient tactics and universe. So in our case, that's exactly what David has to do. He's got to figure out a way to get his soldiers inside the walls, and to do so through the water source. Kol makei yivusi v'ika batzinor. Take the water tunnel and enter the city. Now, once you're not going to send, so the reason why, and this is where I come back to this comment of Yadin, this is hardly feasible, for the tunnel was narrow and vertical. Now, Charles Warren wanted to prove that it's doable. So he climbed it himself. Yeah. And he managed to climb with picks and whatever your mountain rock climbing tools that you have. He managed to climb the entire shaft. So he therefore claimed that this was in fact the water shaft of Yigabe Tsinor. And ever since that point in time, it's been challenged, because how does an entire army
get to
climb a 13 meter vertical shaft? Well, the answer is very simple. I don't need the entire army to climb the 13 meter shaft. That's what I think the piece that is missing here. You don't need the entire army to climb the shaft. What do you need? Janet, you're mute.
Well, a person that brings a rope ladder so people can climb up.
I wouldn't even say a rope ladder. I would argue probably a more powerful solution. Have you heard the story of the Trojan horse? You need a handful of soldiers to get inside the city to open up the city gates.
Oh, yeah.
All you need is this infiltrating army to open the gates. The rest of the army is on the ramparts at the top of the wall. Get a small group of soldiers through the through the shaft, through the Gihon spring, into the city, open up the gates, and David's army just walks right through. So ultimately, that's why when Yadin said here, it's hardly possible, hardly feasible for the tunnel was vertical and narrow, I would agree that it's hardly feasible for an entire army to get through. I don't necessarily know that David needed the whole army to get through. I think all he needed was two or three to get inside the city undetected. And while all the rest of the soldiers are sitting on the ramparts, open up the gates, and David doesn't even bother going to the ramparts. He just walks right through. That's the story, and that's why I think the Tsinor is such a significant part of the story. So, bring that all together,
Rabbi,
and, yes?
Does he not still have the issue of scaling the hill and the wall?
Not if you enter through the gates. The hill is less of the issue, the wall is the bigger issue, but if the gates open, you just walk right through. I don't know where the gate is, but let's assume for the moment, gate is somewhere, wherever it is, and you kind of, the army's over here, you kind of just walk in. Now, by the way, this also helps me understand Rashi. And I want to come back to Rashi for a second. Because Rashi made the comment that the Yigabe Tsinor, Lashon Gova HaMigdal, Shem Migdal. And I asked the question earlier, what's the connection between Tsinor and the Migdal? The Tsinor is a water source or water term, and the Migdal is a tower. But once I assume that the water source we're talking about is in fact the Gihon spring, then I have a solution to Rashi too. Because the archaeologists argue that on top of the Gihon spring was a fortress built in the time of the Canaanites. And that fortress protected the spring from attack. So even though it was outside the walls of the old walls of the city, it was included in a towering fortress to protect it specifically from for the purpose of the city itself. And so when David rebuilt the walls, you can see these are this is a rendition of the walls that David rebuilt, and that's sort of the city of David in David's time, that's the palace. This is that same rebuilt fortress. So if the Tsinor is the reference to the Gihon spring, then the Migdal could be referring to the tower that protected the same spring. So it could, in fact, both be right. All right, I'm going to bring it all together into, that's just the story of the Trojan horse. So I'm going to skip that. And I'm going to come back to this. This is an interesting piece from Ministry Tours of Israel, and it talks about Warren's Pier and Charles Warren. And sit back, enjoy. I'm going to share with you a 5-minute video clip. No way to appreciate this better than to see it in a 5-minute video clip. Okay. I gotta actually reshare it with you. So hang on one second, one second. Okay. Anyone here?
About 3,000 years ago, David, son of Jesse, is crowned king of Israel. This is the beginning of the royal house of David. David decides that Jerusalem, positioned at the heart of the Israelite territory, will be the capital of his kingdom. But Jerusalem is a...
I'm trying to get rid of this line on the bottom, because you need to read the footnotes. Okay, let's do it this way.
Jerusalem is a powerful and intimidating Canaanite city, and until David's time, no tribe has been able to conquer it. Now, once again, confident of their fortifications, the Jebusites take up positions on the city walls. The young King David challenges the complacent enemy. He is determined. This time, Jerusalem must fall.
אני עומד על המדרון המזרחי של עיר דוד. כאן בשנת 1995 מצאו הארכיאולוגים פרופסור רוני רייך ואלי שוקרון שרידים של מגדל ענק שנבנה על ידי הכנענים לפני כ-4,000 שנה. האבנים האלה, שכל אחת מהן שוקלת מספר רב של טונות, הן חלק ממגדל עצום שנבנה ממש כאן בסמוך למעיין הגיחון.
You shall not come in here.
The Jebusites mock David. They station blind and lame men on the city walls. The message is clear. The city is so strong that even the blind and the lame can easily defend it.
David מבין שבדרכים מקובלות הוא לא יצליח לכבוש את העיר. פה צריך לחשוב מחוץ לקופסה. בראש שלו כבר נרקמת מזימה.
He promises the esteemed position of head of the army to the soldier who dares to volunteer for this dangerous mission and succeeds. One man rises to the challenge, Joab ben Tzeruya, a tough and daring soldier. But what is the mission? In his challenge, David uses two mysterious words, Veiga Batzinor. What is this tzinor that David is referring to? Thousands of years later, a fascinating discovery was made, shedding light on the mysterious tzinor. In 1867, the archaeologist Captain Charles Warren crawled through a tunnel near the Gihon Spring. About 20 meters from the spring, Warren discovered a vertical shaft that rose to a height of 13 meters above his head. With great effort, Warren climbed to the top of the shaft, where, to his amazement, he discovered that the tunnel continued to rise steeply until it reached the city above.
Warren הבין מיד שלפניו מפעל מים סודי שנבנה לפני אלפי שנים. התכנון היה מתוחכם ביותר. הכנענים ידעו שנקודת התורפה של איראן היא המעיין שנמצא מחוץ לחומות העיר.
They built a great citadel around the spring and dug a tunnel down from the city above to the citadel surrounding the spring.
דוד מגלה את מפעל המים הקדום. זה הצינור.
He sends Joab ben Tzeruya through this tunnel to infiltrate the city. After Joab exits the tunnel, he runs down to the city gates. The Jebusite soldiers fail to notice him. Joab reaches the city gates and opens them with great force. Before the Jebusites can grasp what has happened, David's soldiers burst through the gates and take the city by surprise. But David captured the fortress of Zion, which is the city of David.
and more or less sums it all up, with the one exception of the question as to whether or not the blind and the lame were there to taunt David or to scare him, Josephus's approach or Yadin's approach. I think that more or less the consensus is that the Tzinor refers to something related to that source of water, the Gihon spring. Yoav enters the city, opens the gates, and as they say in the vernacular, the rest was history. So that's the story of the conquest of Yerushalayim. Questions? Okay. I'm going to adjourn us a little bit early today. I apologize. I've got a couple of things on that I want to that I need to address. I just want to finish with one observation, and that is, come back to the text for a second. After David enters Yerushalayim, Vayeshev David b'Metzuda, Vayikra la Ir David, he names the city Ir David, which is not surprising. Vayiven David saviv min ha-milo vavayta. David began to build from the Milo. Milo is a term that uses, it's not translated here, but it comes from the word lamalo, to fill, which is probably a reference either to the valley, like the landfill, the support of the walls, or possibly a moat of some kind that was used to prevent people from coming in. But he built min ha-milo vavayta, inwards. In other words, what David starts to build is what we know to be the city of David. You know, from this wall, or the Milo, inwards, towards, or possibly from this part of the city, inwards. Whoops. And Ve'elach David haloch v'gadol, v'ashem elokei tzva'ot imo. David begins to increase in stature and power from a newly established capital, from a place of centrally located center of the country, uniting the tribes of Israel. David's power, fame, significance begins to grow exponentially, and the rest of the next stage of the story of Sefer Shmuel, for the next five or six chapters, are a description of his military conquests and the expanse of the kingdom, and ultimately the sort of the bulk of the world of David's life through the setting the stage for the moving of the Aron to Yerushalayim, and ultimately the possibility of building the Beit HaMikdash. It's a lot of pieces here, but it all stems from this moment of the success of the conquest of Yerushalayim. What happens next in this perek are two stories, the building of his palace by Chiram Malachar, and then two battles with the Plishtim. The chronology here is not clear, so there's a lot of layers to uncover. What I'm going to suggest is that we're going to stop here, and we will continue. Now, my question to you, so I'm going to open this up as a conversation for a few minutes. Actually, I'm going to stop the recording here, because at this point I've adjourned the shiur part of today. So.